Party's ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed. Who's first? Come right up.
I believe I am, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning. I'm Fred Finkelstein, counsel for appellants Joseph and Midori Sackett. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
In my opening argument, I'd like to focus on the facts that are at the heart of this appeal. In 2007, First Church obtained a construction loan from the bank. In the years that followed, numerous disputes arose between the bank and First Church. One of those disputes involved the bank's claim, which was not true, and which First Church vehemently denied, that First Church had diverted loan proceeds that were dispersed by the bank. In April 2010, the bank and First Church entered into an agreement, which is called the workout agreement, to put aside their differences so that construction could be completed and the townhomes sold. First Church knew that the bank's allegation regarding the diverted funds was false. Nevertheless, it insisted that the bank release these claims for obvious reasons. Significantly, the bank agreed to do so. In paragraph 9.1, paren 2 of the workout agreement, all of the bank's claims against First Church, including its claim that First Church had diverted funds, were, quote, irrevocably and unconditionally forever, close quote, released. This release language is going to be important when I get to the heart of what occurred here. Another critical fact is that United Commercial Bank, which owned two-thirds of the bank's loan to First Church, failed, and its interest in the loan was acquired by East West Bank. This was significant for two reasons. First, the FDIC had guaranteed that East West Bank would not lose money on the loan. After the workout agreement was signed, Keith McClellan from the bank told Joel Lavin, an owner of First Church, that East West Bank was furious because the workout agreement jeopardized these FDIC guarantees. Second, Tim Patrick, who was the receiver under the workout agreement, worked for East West Bank on many other matters. This understandably worried First Church, who wondered whether this would be a neutral receiver under the workout agreement, and Patrick acknowledged in writing to First Church that he had a possible conflict of interest. Patrick told First Church in writing that he would seek a waiver of this conflict from East West Bank. Significantly, East West Bank never provided the waiver. So again, I'll come back to why these facts are so significant. Patrick resigned as receiver after 3 months. Significantly, when he resigned, Patrick never said why, and the bank in the trial court never submitted a declaration from him as to why he resigned.
Counsel, let me ask you some questions about the hearing to approve the settlement agreement. The first question I have is, was the Woodson case, which is argued on appeal, argued to the trial court below? The reason I ask that is that during the hearing, the court made some determinations but did not refer to that case.
The Woodson case was cited, I know, by Mr. Hanchett in his motion to have the settlement approved.
Okay, so the receiver who had the burden at that hearing laid that out as
yes.
a guide by which the court would make the determination.
Yes, and I think it was agreed, Your Honor, that the fair and equitable standard is the proper standard.
So on appeal, that's the same position taken by both parties, that Woodson is the guiding light here.
I think so. I know we certainly believe so, and we think Woodson is absolutely the critical case as far as how the facts, obviously not directly on point, but very similar, and the fact that the court found that in that case, in Woodson, it wasn't a compromise. It was really a totally one-sided settlement. The creditor in Woodson getting zero, the debtor in that case getting $900,000, and the court saying no responsible trustee would have proposed such a settlement.
So in this particular proceeding, the trial court took a look at the various claims that were asserted and made an evaluation that this, I think her words were, this is the best compromise that's going to take place, or words to that effect, correct?
Well, I think what happened, Your Honor, is the judge just accepted everything that the receiver asserted. I think a lot of trial judges just have this inclination of The receiver is neutral. The receiver is appointed. They're not going to totally defer to what the receiver says, but they're largely going to agree with what the receiver
says. So is it your position that the trial court did not fairly evaluate the various claims that were being asserted?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And also failed to acknowledge or evaluate or take into consideration the bias that, in this case, the receiver had exhibited in writing. It's not a case where, I mean, most of these kinds of cases, you would have to infer that the receiver might be biased just because of the positions that the receiver takes. But in this case, the receiver put on his website, right in the middle of the dispute, while the case was ongoing, that the bank was a client. This is an attorney saying that the bank, one of the parties in this dispute, is a client. Then he said that witnesses who were going to be trial witnesses if the case went to trial were referrals, witnesses, employees of the bank. He listed them as referrals for why people should select him as a receiver. And then he had a video on his website that said he was appointed by the bank, quote, quote, unquote. Those statements are clearly improper from a receiver who's supposed to be neutral. I mean, it's black letter law. A receiver is supposed to be neutral, act in the best interests of all parties. And I think the trial court failed to take that into consideration. This was not a typical case where you've got a receiver who's acting impartially. This is something that's totally indifferent, totally different. And the fact that the product of that bias in this case was a settlement agreement that was totally one-sided. The bank paid $10,000, which it's not crystal clear where that $10,000 went, but Mr. Hanchett's statements at oral arguments suggest it went to him for the cost of the motion for his investigation. Even if it didn't go to him, $10,000 in exchange for having to give up a seven-figure claim, $1.5 to $3 million, is clearly not a balanced compromise. And then the key part of that settlement, which I think is critical for the court to understand, is the bank had already released the claim for diverted funds. That's why I quote the release language from the workout agreement. I don't know how a release agreement can be any clearer than saying it's unconditional, it's irrevocable, and it's forever. The bank released that claim. So therefore, when the bank says, as consideration for this settlement agreement, we're going to give up this $900,000 claim, it's a red herring. It's already been released. Plus, at the hearing and in opposition...
Is the $900,000 the potential deficiency against the guarantors?
Well, they'd already released their claims against the guarantor.
My question is that the potential, is that the measure of what you're talking about when you're talking about $900,000?
Well, they claim that's the amount of the diverted funds.
Okay, so,
yes.
All right.
Okay, you have, did you reserve how many minutes?
I think I said two, Your Honor.
All right, so you have your 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
If it please the court, good morning. My name is Susan Fox, and I represent the respondent in this action, the bank, Charter Bank. The receivership in this case worked exactly the way the receivership statute anticipated it to work. The asset was preserved. It was enhanced. The project was completed to its maximum value. The secured claims were addressed, and collateral litigation was avoided. Because the $9.3 million that the bank had loaned First Church was already in default, the bank had the right to simply start a foreclosure action and seek a deficiency against the individuals. But I think the bank understood that the value of this case was getting the project completed. And from the very beginning of the case, the bank wanted a receiver appointed who could take control of the project, complete the project, get it done, get it sold, not deal with the other collateral cross-claims and extra-contractual claims that only result in a lot of litigation and usually don't result in any more money to be paid to the debts. And that is exactly what happened. Part of the receiver's job was to take a look at what claims were for and against the estate, in this case First Church, and determine whether or not there was a settlement possible for those claims. That is the issue that is before the court this morning on the receiver's motion to approve a settlement which relieved First Church of $900,000 claim by the bank for diverted funds in return for dismissing claims that that First Church claimed to have against the bank, and in addition, the bank paid an additional $10,000. As an observation, let me note that this appeal is probably largely moot. There is no remedy available to the appellants because they failed to preserve the issue. Although they originally identified the court's order which terminated the receivership as a basis for appeal, they abandoned it by not arguing it in their initial opening brief. Raising it in appeal by simply saying, well, all of our other arguments apply, is simply too late. But not only that, Your Honors, there is no available remedy because the appellants took no steps to try and stay the court's order terminating the receivership. At this point, there is no receivership. All of the money has been dispersed. The receiver has been excused. So how do we unwind a settlement where the bank paid $10,000 that it's not getting back from anywhere because there is no where to get it back from? So the appeal is moot because the appellants failed to take the appropriate step to either preserve the issue or stay the effect of the judge's order terminating the receivership. The appellants in this case have argued the wrong standard of review from the very beginning. This is not a de novo case. The judge below had the right, as the court has noted, under the Woodson case, the standard is abuse of discretion. And it is the fact that there were issues of material fact, disputed issues of fact, you know, questions about what claim was which, exactly makes the receiver's point. Namely, there were disputed cross-claims that needed to get settled. It didn't matter whether or not the court entered into a factual finding. What the court found, and the only way to overturn her is find an abuse of discretion standard, was that the receiver had looked into those arguments. Mr. Finkelstein makes a couple of arguments with respect to waiver. Interestingly, the first argument he says is that there was a diversion of funds and that there was never that the bank had against First Church that up to $900,000 of funds were diverted was not true. Well, that's simply wrong, and it's wrong based on the brief that he filed below. In fact, First Church in their tax returns admitted that it had taken loan funds and given them to other entities in clear violation of the loan documents. Now, it came in at the hearing below and argued, oh, yeah, by the way, there's no documentation of this, but we actually paid that money back. What that was a factual dispute. The receiver looked at the claim that the bank had, a fairly solid claim that says, hey, you have stolen $900,000 from this project. It knew that First Church would likely argue waiver. All that meant is it's a contested claim. On the other side, the receiver was trying to eliminate claims against First Church, and he was able to do that by essentially offsetting those claims. The bank agreed to walk away from the $900,000 claim and pay an additional $10,000, which didn't go to Mr. Hanchett, which in fact went into the receiver's account, which it is supposed to do. He filed the financial reports every month with the court, which were never objected to by the appellants. And in return, the other two claims, which the court found, frankly, were fairly weak, were then dismissed. The court did go through a very lengthy hearing in which she ultimately found at the end of the day that the appellant's arguments were weak in terms of whether or not and who had breached the forbearance agreement. This gets into the waiver argument, and I won't spend much time on it because, frankly, I don't think there's a legal leg to stand on. But what appellants are essentially arguing is that the bank waived the argument with respect to the diverted funds by relying on an agreement which their client breached. And the trial court had absolutely no problem in saying you can't put forward the release in a document and say that that is binding when that's the very contract that your client breached. You can't have it both ways, or it would be a great coup for anyone. Get the other side to release all their claims, then promptly breach the agreement. What it shows, Your Honor, and I would submit, is that these were going to be contested claims in the litigation. The receiver saw that and sought to take them out. What the receiver also knew was, although there would be a lot of costs in litigation and attorney's fees spent in terms of fighting out these arguments, it wasn't going to result in another dollar into the estate. Therefore, there wouldn't be any money collected because the claims were going to offset, and yet there would be a lot of money spent in litigation, which is one of the factors that you see in the Woodson case and in the AP Properties case as well. So we think that the judge was clearly within her purview and certainly met the abuse of discretion standard in finding that the proposed settlement was fair and reasonable. It worked with every aspect of the bank's idea that get the project and the property done, let's eliminate the claims against the individuals, let's eliminate the cross-contractual claims, and just focus on letting the receiver do his job.
Counsel, you're asking for attorney's fees against the, is it Sakote?
Sackett, I believe.
And I understand it's on the basis of the construction loan agreement?
Yeah, the construction loan agreement is the...
I understand what it is. Did the Sakotes sign the construction loan agreement?
The borrower was First Church.
I understand that.
They didn't sign...
The difference between a borrower and a guarantor.
There is. And they signed the guarantee agreements, which are part of all the loan documents.
But you're asking for fees on the basis of the construction loan agreement.
Of the construction loan.
That I understand was not signed by the Sakotes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
So why would we do that?
Because I think the construction loan agreement is one part of the entire loan package of which the Sacketts did sign the guarantee agreements in order to get the construction loan agreement approved. So we look at those documents as part of all one loan package.
Is there authority for doing that for purposes of deciding whether somebody owes attorney's fees on a contract?
Not that I've cited to the court. So... the other argument, and I just briefly want to touch on, is the standing argument. It was not addressed, I think, here. But the reality of the situation is Mr. and Mrs. Sackett are the appellants in this case individually. They have no standing to try and upset this settlement. They weren't borrowers. They're not shareholders. They're not members of the First Church LLC. Mrs. Sackett isn't even a member of the LLC, which is a member of a First Church LLC. They don't have any, they're not creditors of the LLC, so they don't make the standard either under the receivership statute or under the bankruptcy code that talks about who has the right to upset a settlement. This receivership was a very well-run receivership and resulted, although the secured claims, it still wasn't enough to pay off all the secured claims, it maximized the project without unnecessary litigation and unnecessary costs. And I would urge the court to affirm the court below and find that the settlement was reasonable and within the trial judge's discretion.
Thank you.
Your Honor, it's a few things. Counsel raised a number of arguments for the first time in her oral argument just now. Every argument that counsel raised in their response was addressed in my reply brief. So I would urge the court to disregard a number of the arguments that she raised, legal arguments that were not set forth in the response. As far as the release goes, the respondent did not cite a single case that supports their argument that the release should be disregarded because my client allegedly breached it. The release is, again, unconditional, irrevocable, and forever. The attorney who represented First Church at that time, who negotiated the agreement, said the intent of the agreement, and this is in the record, the intent of the agreement was that if there's a breach of the workout agreement, the bank's remedy was to sue and try to recover the loan proceeds that it had dispersed. It had released its claim for diverted funds. That's why when you look at the settlement and the bank talks about $900,000 being part of the negotiation, it's not true. The $900,000 claim was forever, quote-unquote, released in the workout agreement. Second, the bank, First Church, never admitted that these funds were diverted. That's absolutely false. And at the hearing, in connection with the hearing, First Church submitted a substantial amount of evidence, which the trial court just totally disregarded, that the funds were not diverted. In this case, the other thing to remember, Your Honor, is that the trial judge completely ignored the interests of all of the creditors except the bank. Not a single creditor in this case who helped build this project got a dime, because once the settlement agreement was approved, it guaranteed no creditor would get paid. And the court disregarded that the paramount interests of creditors must be considered by the trial court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our next case this morning will be Allstate Indemnity versus Angarita.